So I just got back from Greece, and while I was there, I visited Olympia, site of the original ancient Olympic Games, where my favorite Olympian, Milo of Croton, would carry a cow on his shoulders the entire length of the field just to slaughter and eat it when he got there. So to honor Milo and other ancient Greek Olympians, I've decided to make an ancient Greek recipe for marinated calf's liver skewers served with figs, feta, and barley bread. So thank you to HelloFresh for sponsoring this video as we bulk up like an ancient Greek Olympian. This time on Tasting History. So asking the question, what did an ancient Greek Olympian eat, turns out to have a lot of answers, because the ancient Olympics were pan-Hellenistic. So men came from all over the Greek-speaking world, from city-states as far as Iberia in the west, all the way to the shores of the Black Sea in the east. Also, the games took place over a very long period of time, at least from 776 BC all the way to 393 AD. And so, over that span of time, eating habits tended to change, especially because just like today, there always seemed to be a new fad diet for athletes. When it comes to the very first Olympic Games, Diogenes says that athletes trained on dried figs, on soft cheese, and on wheat meal. So that's easy enough, but not too complicated, so I'm going to fast forward a couple centuries to about the 6th century BC, when it said that their food was bread made from barley and unleavened loaves of unsifted wheat. For meat, they ate the flesh of oxen, bulls, goats, and deer. So we'll get some figs, some feta cheese, and some of the dry barley bread from Crete known as paximadi. That is this. It's basically over-baked or twice-baked barley bread that has turned into hardtack. What we're cooking, though, is the meat, and for that I'm looking to an ancient Greek recipe written on a papyrus that was found in Egypt. The Greek text says, cut up good liver, marinate in oil with salt, cilantro, thyme, silphium juice, vinegar. Grill on a spit at high temperature. Serve. Now, liver is a rather polarizing meat, so if it's not your cup of tea, feel free to swap it out with a different protein so you are actually making something that you want to eat. It's the same thing that you can do when you order meals from today's sponsor, HelloFresh. Like last night when I made the sweet chili pork bowls. They give you the option to have it with ground beef or ground turkey. Personally, I stuck with the pork, which paired well with the sweet and zesty sauce for an absolutely delightful dinner. And having a choice of protein is really just the beginning, because HelloFresh has 40 weekly recipes to choose from with meals to fit just about every lifestyle, whether it's vegetarian, pescatarian, family-friendly, or if you're in a rush, you can opt for their quick and easy recipes. All of the ingredients come pre-portioned, so you can get right to cooking and have dinner ready in no time. And it's not just dinner, because HelloFresh now offers breakfasts, lunch, snacks, and even desserts. So if you want to start cooking more at home without the hassle of going grocery shopping, then visit HelloFresh.com and use my code TASTINGHISTORY16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. This offer is for new subscriptions only and varies by plan across 9 boxes. That's TASTINGHISTORY16 for 16 free meals at HelloFresh.com. Now for this recipe, which is not from HelloFresh, what you'll need is 1 pound or a half kilo of calf's liver, or any other meat. I actually don't even like liver, but I'm having it because that is what is in the ancient Greek recipe, but if you want to do sirloin or chicken, then do it. 9 tablespoons or 135 milliliters of olive oil, 3 tablespoons or 45 milliliters of red wine vinegar, a small bunch of cilantro chopped up, 2 tablespoons of thyme leaves, a teaspoon of salt, and a pinch of asafoetida powder. Now that last ingredient might have you saying, I didn't see asafoetida in that original recipe, and you're right, it actually called for silphium. But silphium went extinct, maybe, because now they actually think that they possibly found the plant that it was in parts of Turkey, but either way, you're not going to get a hold of it, so asafoetida is the way to go. Even in ancient Rome, when they ran out of silphium during the reign of Nero, they switched to using asafoetida. Now, one thing you want to be sure of when you're using this ingredient is that you just use a pinch, about an eighth of a teaspoon at most. It has a really, really strong flavor, and especially before it gets cooked, it does not smell good. They call it devil's dung. That's another name for it. It smells like rotting, burnt garlic and onions. Once it's cooked, it has a very unique and lovely flavor, but before cooked, not so much. So if you're going to store it in your pantry, make sure to seal it, put it into a Ziploc bag or two, and then put it in there. Otherwise, everything's going to smell that way. So first, take the liver and slice it into bite-sized pieces, about an inch or so. Then, in a large bowl, add the vinegar and pour in the olive oil in a stream, vigorously whisking the entire time. This will help the ingredients emulsify. Continue to whisk until the two are fairly well mixed, and then whisk in the salt and the asafoetida powder, as well as the cilantro and thyme. Then add in the chopped liver and mix until it's well coated and set aside to marinate. Now you can leave this out of the fridge and let it marinate for like an hour, or better yet, put it into the refrigerator and let it marinate overnight. Once the meat has marinated, put the pieces onto a wooden or metal skewer and set it over an open fire or in the oven. I've opted to use a little grill for this one, so I get some of that smoky flavor and a bit of char on the liver. I think it'll help with the texture. And after about 4 minutes on one side, just turn the skewers over and cook for another 4 or 5 minutes, or until they're cooked all the way through. Cooking it will help with the texture, but it's also going to let those flavors mellow, because there are some really strong flavors fighting for dominance in this dish. You've got the liver itself, which is a very strong flavor, as well as vinegar and cilantro and the asafoetida powder, which can be very, very overpowering if you use too much. It's like the Flavor Olympics. And before we find out who's going to win these Olympics, let's talk about the ancient Greek Olympics and the diet of an ancient Olympian. The first recorded Olympics took place in Olympia, Greece, in the year 776 BC, and were held every 4 years for nearly 1,200 years. They began as part of a larger religious festival to honor the god Zeus, which is why at Olympia they had the great golden statue of Zeus, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Now, the athletes that competed were all male Greek citizens, or after the rise of the Roman Empire, male Roman citizens. But especially before the rise of the empire, it was not always safe to travel in the Greek-speaking world because the city-states were always fighting. Hence, in the months surrounding the games, a sacred truce known as Echeheria was called. Athletes, officials, and spectators were all under the protection of the Echeheria, and should you break this truce, then you would be banned from participating in the Olympics. There was actually one point where the entire city of Sparta was banned for just that reason. Now, the link between the games and food starts with the very first winner of the first recorded Olympics. He was a man named Corivos, and he was a cook and baker from the nearby town of Elis, which was the town that hosted the Olympics. But it wasn't baking that won him the kotinos, or the olive wreath, that they gave to winners, but rather it was because he won the stadion, which was a race around the stadium, and was, at that point in time, the only game that there was. It was one race, so it was quick, and then, you know, they'd go on and do the rest of the festival. It actually wasn't until the 12th Olympic Games that more events began to be added. Eventually, there were 18 events that included several foot races, wrestling, boxing, chariot racing, horse racing, and the hoplitodromos, which was a race dressed in full armor of the Greek military, including helmet, shield, and spear. And that makes sense because for much of the history of the Olympics, it was a way to show one's military prowess. So many of the games mimicked things that you would be doing on the battlefield. Even the training would be things that were done in battle. Like the ancients talk about Olympians training by holding four horses by their reins or dressing all in that armor and then going swimming. Less militaristic activities might include chasing wild animals around, or as we do today, just lifting heavy things. Like on the Isle of Thira, sometimes now called Santorini, there was a stone of volcanic rock found. It weighed 1,060 pounds, and it was inscribed with the name of the strongman Olympian who had lifted it up off the ground. Evmastas, the son of Korytovoulos, lifted me from the ground. Now, much of this training was done in a gymnasio, or gymnasium, which is quite different from what we think of as a gym today. One of the big differences was it wasn't just a place to train your body, but also to train your mind. They would have libraries and lecture halls attached, and there are even a number of dialogues from the great philosophers like Plato and Antiochus, which take place in gymnasio. It was all about gaining control over the mind as well as the body, and some of the training was more centered on your mind. Like, you would spend an entire day just doing breathing techniques, or you would have to stand for 2 full days with your arms raised up in the air. I could go maybe for like 5 minutes. One of the more common ways to focus your mind so you were ready to compete was to abstain from sex. A man named Clitomachos, who was a champion at Pankration, a sort of violent fusion of boxing and wrestling, took his abstention from sex during training to a whole new level. If anyone at dinner turned the conversation to copulation, he would stand up and leave. And on the streets, if he saw dogs entwined, he turned away. He was definitely hardcore, as was anyone who practiced any of these sports that involved boxing, because they didn't wear any kind of protective headgear, and the bouts could last up to 4 hours and really only stopped when somebody either gave up or broke the rules. The Roman poet Lucilius wrote about the face of one of these contestants after a fight. When Ulysses returned to his birthplace after 20 years of absence, his dog recognized him immediately. You, on the other hand, are so unrecognizable after 4 hours of fighting that neither dogs nor people will know who you are. And it's said that Evridamas, a man from Kyrene, lost most of his teeth during a boxing bout, but swallowed them rather than spit them out just so he wouldn't give his opponent the satisfaction of knowing that he'd knocked most of his teeth out. Though the severity of some of these fights might have been rather exaggerated by some of the later authors, like the Roman Pausanias wrote that a Greek named Demoxenos once punched a man in the gut during a fight, and with the sharpness of his nails and the force of the blow, he drove his hand into his adversary, caught his bowels, and tore them out. I mean, that's some real Mortal Kombat stuff right there.
Fatality.
Perhaps my favorite story of Olympic training comes from the 6th century BC wrestler and winner of 6 Olympic Games, Milo of Croton. Now, he was very likely a real person, but the tales of Milo have gone to mythic proportions, and so it's kind of hard to tell what's real and what's not. But they still give us an idea of what the ancient Greeks thought were great feats of strength. He would grasp a pomegranate so firmly that nobody could wrest it from him by force, and yet he did not himself crush it. He would stand upon a greased quoit and make fools of those who charged him and tried to push him from the quoit. He would tie a cord round his forehead as though it were a crown, holding his breath and filling with blood the veins on his head. He would break the cord by the strength of these veins. But most famously, it was said that following each Olympic game, he would get a calf and would carry it around on his shoulders for the next 4 years until the next Olympic Games, at which point it would be a full-grown cow weighing like 1,200 pounds. So probably not true, but still, great story. Then he would take the cow and walk the entire length of the Olympic Stadium and slaughter it. Then they would feast on this cow. Details of that are sparse, but I'm gonna say that they probably marinated it and put it on skewers before roasting it, just like we're doing with the liver today. Either way, it would have been a lot of food, so surely he shared it. Because even the most outlandish stories of Milo of Croton say that he ate 17 pounds of meat a day, far from a full cow. Now, whether or not he was actually eating a full cow at the beginning of each Olympic Games, or even had a cow to eat, it is definite that people feasted on beef at the end of the Olympic Games, because on that last day, they would make a sacrifice of 100 oxen, known as a hecatomb. They would be brought up to the altar of Zeus and sacrificed. Then they would be roasted or boiled, and the smoke or steam would rise up to appease the gods, leaving a lot of meat for everybody else to eat. And for most Greeks, that was the only time that you really got to eat a lot of meat. Though Greek Olympians were far from your average Greek, most of them came from very wealthy military families who could afford meat, and should they win, they would be treated like celebrities and would often be given free food for life. Though, like Diogenes says, at least at the beginning of the Olympic Games, the Olympians didn't want meat. They wanted dried figs, soft cheese, and wheat meal. It wasn't until Pythagoras came along that meat was on the menu. Diogenes says that he was the first to prescribe athletes a diet of meat, the first athlete being Evrimenes. What's interesting is that while many people agree that this Pythagoras is the Pythagoras of Pythagorean theorem fame, Diogenes is not so sure. Yes, he does include this tidbit in his biography of Pythagoras. He says that that Pythagoras was a vegetarian, and so it might have been a different Pythagoras altogether, though according to another ancient writer, Pausanias, it wasn't Pythagoras at all who brought meat to the table. Rather, he says it was a long-distance runner named Dromaeos of Stymphalios. He is said to have conceived the idea of a meat diet. Up to this time, athletes had fed on cheese from the basket. But whoever it was, by the 6th century BC, people had stopped just eating figs and cheese and had definitely gotten on that meat train. This is the point when Philostratus says that they would eat their barley bread as well as oxen, bulls, goats, and deer. Now, he was from Athens, but was writing at the height of the Roman Empire, and he kind of pined for the older days, the pre-Rome days in Greece. And he says that the ancient Olympians, not only did they eat meat, but they washed in rivers and springs, learned to sleep on the ground, others on beds made of straw they gathered from the field. They rubbed themselves with the oil of the wild olive and philia. This style of living made them free from sickness, and they kept their youth a long time. Some of them competed in 8 Olympic Games, others for 9. They were also excellent soldiers. They made war a training for athletics, and they made athletics a training for war. He laments that the Greek athlete under Roman rule had become not a warrior, but a civilian, lazy and soft, in large part due to their diet. As the Sicilian gluttony for fancy food has gained popularity, the guts went out of athletics, and more important, trainers became too easy on their pupils. Doctors gave us chefs and cooks to please our palates. They turned athletics into gluttons with bottomless stomachs. Doctors fed us the bread of Mykonos, white bread made of ground meal sprinkled with poppy seeds, and introduced the eating of fish, contrary to previous medical practice. They also introduced the use of pork to athletes. Luckily, Philostratus also gave us a way to clock these overeating athletes, should you come across one. You can recognize an athlete who overeats by his thick eyebrows, gasping breath, and prominent collarbones, as well as rolls of fat around his waist. Those who drink too much wine have an excessive paunch, and too much drinking is noted by a quick pulse. But if, as an athlete preparing for the Olympics, you find that you have indeed eaten a bit too much, worry not. For those athletes who have eaten too much should be massaged in a downward direction so that the excess weight may be removed from the important parts of the body. Oh, how I wish it actually worked that way. Just like squeezing toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube. I do appreciate his advice to those who have imbibed a little bit too much the night before training. An excess of wine in the athlete's body requires moderate exercise to bring on sweating. We should not make people in this condition take hard exercise, but we should not excuse them from their workout entirely. And it is a good rule of thumb not to push yourself too hard after a long night of partying. There's actually a story of an ancient Greek Olympian who won the Olympics. His name was Yerinos, and after he won, he decided to celebrate and partied with his friends, drinking a lot and eating a bit too much. As a consequence of this unaccustomed way of life, he was short on sleep. On the 3rd day after his victory, he came to the gymnasium and told his trainer that his stomach was upset and that he felt terrible. Well, the teacher was a bit upset because Yerinos had thrown off the tetrad, which was the 4-day training cycle of Olympians, and so as punishment, he made the workout even harder, and halfway through, Yerinos just died. Which is probably why I'm not cut out to be an ancient Greek Olympian, but that doesn't mean that I can't eat like one. And here we are, a meal fit for an ancient Greek Olympian. So I'm gonna start with the liver, even though I don't really like liver. Here we go. So first, the good stuff. The flavor is actually surprisingly uniform and mild. None of the flavors, the very strong flavors, are popping out as kind of dominating everything else. You get that asafoetida. There's definitely like a garlickiness there, kind of a burnt garlic, but in a pleasant way, and it's not overpowering. It can be overpowering. the liver is not overpowering, and that's actually what I was most worried about. The flavor is quite nice. It's earthy, but it doesn't have that metallic taste that sometimes liver has. It's more of an earthy, kind of an herby flavor, and you do get that smoke. Now for the not so nice. I don't like liver. Sorry, I'm knocking things off. I just don't like liver. The texture is so... I'm expecting meat, and I'm getting, like, really chewy mushroom. Like, it's kind of chewy and then porous, and then kind of, like, just dissolves into grit. That's not a good thing. Also, gets stuck in your teeth. Like, not a fan of that. I would definitely go with something more like a sirloin, but, you know, is what it is. Now, when it comes to the figs and cheese, I mean, it's gonna be delicious, I know it is. So good. One thing I really love is those two things, the saltiness of the feta and the sweetness of these figs. They just complement each other so well. And then these, the basically Cretan hardtack. Let me crunch on this. The flavor is fantastic. So to sum it up, cheese, fantastic. Figs, fantastic. The bread, fantastic, even if it is a little bit hard to eat. And the meat, the flavor, A+. The texture, F. Just hate that. But, you know, use a different meat and then it's gonna be absolutely fantastic. And it is a unique flavor that you're not gonna get with a lot of modern foods. So, yeah. So if you stuck around to the end of the video, I am going to share with you a little bit more about Milo of Croton and specifically how he died. There was an old tree stump that was in his town, and so he decided that he was going to rip it apart and tear it out from the ground. But he can't. The tree wedges his arm in, and he can't get his arm out. And so that night, dogs and lions or wild beasts come and devour him. So we don't really know what the moral of that story is, except don't, you know, stick your arm inside of a dead tree. It might get stuck and you'll get eaten by animals. I guess that's a good moral. It's a good moral. Anyway, make this food, or at least some of it, and I will see you next time on Tasting History.